Welcome to Health Tech Matters, a podcast where we explore the ways how great healthcare products are built. I'm your host, Mary, and each week I talk to startup founders, product managers, and designers working in healthcare startups. In this episode, we are discussing the ways how to make remote user interviews insightful, chronic conditions treatment, and design systems. Welcome our guest, Shah Arayo, product designer at Second Nature, an online weight loss program. Core features of the product include personalized plan, one-on-one support by a certified nutritionist and peer support group, healthy recipes, and daily articles on nutrition, sleep, and mental health in the app. Stay tuned. Could you please tell me more about the place where you're working right now and more about the product?
I'm working at Second Nature. Well, the mission of the company is to make healthy living second nature. And with this, the vision for the world is for us to eradicate type 2 diabetes and obesity. The way we're doing this, it's with our product, where we help people lose weight in a healthy way and focus on other aspects of their life. We believe that we're 100% against things like fad diets or quick weight loss schemes. And we believe that this is only possible not with quick ways where you lose like 10 kilos in a week, but in a sustainable way with world-class support that we provide with our app and with our health coaches. Yeah, and it's pretty exciting.
Sounds great. And you're a product designer at Second Nature.
Yeah, I'm a product designer. I've been doing design for like 4 to 5 years. Been in many industries, but once I started diving more into the health tech part, that's where I've been trying to invest a lot of my time on.
You were previously working in Babylon Health. Correct.
Yes, I was in a very similar product, a lot to do with behavior change, more focused on people with type 2 diabetes, but at the same time in the business of helping people change their habits so they can live healthier.
And from product design perspective, what is your biggest challenge for now?
That connecting with people when I'm talking to people over this screen, like a few months ago before this all started, this pandemic, I had the pleasure to being research sessions where I was hearing very intimate, very intense and humbling stories of people who were diagnosed with type 2 diabetes or were living with a condition for many years. It's a bit different when you're with people like in the room with you.
I totally understand you because I had a chance to do the same and it was totally different experience because you need to somehow connect with a person. So how do you do this? How do you connect with a person when she cannot see you like you can see me now?
I'm lucky to have been in these research sessions with people that are really, really good at running them and establishing that emotional connection. I feel like being very attentive to details, very observant of what people say and diving into the whys of certain things that you would just take as like, sometimes people say things that you just assume you know what they mean. But if you keep asking why, you can go a bit deeper into those stories. And that's where you find the gold. That's where you find the juice that like fills those stories, that gives people the fuel to in living their lives and in the passions that they have. I tend to make these sessions a bit too formal. And I'm now working with a product manager and he's really good at creating a very friendly environment, very chilled environment with the participants that we talk to, where he sometimes makes an observation. If a participant has a painting behind them, he might ask, oh, what is that? And then suddenly you might be hearing a story about how their kids painted that. Having a bit of a glimpse of into people's homes when you're doing it digitally.
Can you just remember another example of how your product manager builds this bridge with a person who is so far from him? For example, like noticing things on the background and personal stories.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned now the personal stories. It also works from our point of view as people who are interviewing these people, talking to these people. It's also to give a bit of ourselves. We usually ask a lot of things that are very personal to people because we're talking about their health. And it just feels like you don't want it to be a one-sided exchange where you ask all of these things and you're just a robot consuming this information. So there's an advantage to also opening a space sometimes to share a bit of what you're struggling. It might be the case. Or just to say that you understand their situation. If they're talking about having two kids and how hard that makes to maybe switch the meals at home because I might not like the new ingredients. You can open a space to say, yeah, I also have two of my own. It's not the easiest thing. Not like expend too much on and steal the stage, but has a way of saying, I'm here and I understand what you're saying. I understand that pain and I hear you.
Yeah. I guess it's more about being a person, so a human being, than just a person who's just interviewing you for some job and mechanical work, which is not about souls and not about personal connections.
Totally.
Talking about user research, what do you think people underestimate while doing user research?
My experience, biases that people have, they underestimate how much they might trump research, how they might influence it. It's very common for us to come into projects with an idea in our heads of how we could solve things, of what even the problem is. These biases, they usually lead us to look for the answers we want to hear or research the competitors that are doing the things that we want to do, and that leads us to solve the problem in the same ways that other people have. And there's not really a lot of room there for innovation. This bias also leads us to ask certain questions that are not so good. Asking questions is a very undervalued skill because a poor question will lead to poor results. Poor results will lead to poor insights, which lead to a poorly built product.
What were three questions that you can remember that led to super insightful answers?
Any question that is highly based on the past. People have a lot of problems in their lives and they find the most unusual solutions to them. And the value is in asking questions that help you understand what is this problem that they have and how are they solving it right now? What are the things that they tried to solve that problem? What are the aspects of those solutions that worked and that didn't work? And I don't know, you can be building a financial product to solve a problem that people have. They're currently using a spreadsheet for. What is good about that spreadsheet? What is not so good? And that's probably where you can start innovating. What are the previous solutions they used, but they dropped, and why are they not using them anymore? So any question that helps you understand how people are solving that problem or not even solving it, that's where the value lies.
You actually tackled an interesting problem because right now I'm also a product designer and I work in a healthcare startup. And one thing that is super interesting to me is this connection with the team who's responsible for the medical part of the product. You are, as a product designer, obviously responsible for the results, for the customer satisfaction and so on. But on the other side, you cannot judge if it's medically correct or not. So when you are asking these questions, you are optimizing for customer happiness, customer success. And at the same time, you have a medical doctor who is in the same room and he thinks, okay, this is not the correct way to do it. And we will be doing like this. Okay. Patient doesn't like it, but who cares? This is the correct way. So how do you see this collaboration? And sometimes it's very controversial.
I worked at Babylon and there was a clear process of validating products on to understand if they're medically safe or not. On top of that, it's great when you have those people, those doctors, clinicians, any health professional in your team embedded in the product teams because you can spot things way earlier. You can have them even in ideation sessions when you're considering all these innovative things that you might do that sometimes might be really dangerous. They are the ones who can block them in a session if they are there with you. So that's critical. At the same time, you as a designer, you are the expert on how you can better influence people, how you can get them solutions that they will use. So it happened a lot in situations where medical professionals are trying to propose something like, let's have people track their meals every day because that's really useful information for us. But at the same time, as a designer, you know how hard it is to get people to track their food. It's really hard. You shouldn't ask for product inputs from healthcare professionals. Their value lies in understanding all the expertise in what's safe, what's not. And it's great to understand that in this case, the example I was giving about tracking food, nutrition information from what people are consuming is really important for doctors. That's where the value is in understanding this information. It's not in just building what doctors want. My challenge is to ask more questions about why that initially just translates into let's have people track food, but there's more there. there's the why that is something that you would want as a doctor.
And I guess you had to work a lot with new product ideas, right? So from your own experience, what were the best and the worst ways how you validated product ideas using your design thinking?
Best ways. Well, something that is crucial for me, it's to understand what the hypothesis is. When I say hypothesis, I mean, what is the change in the product that you think that if you do, will result in something, in a result, like adding a notification will get more people to tap on it and indeed add their weight every 2 months, let's say. What is the evidence that supports that hypothesis? Why did we decide with that notification was the best solution to get that result of people adding their weight to the product compared to other hypotheses? And how can you measure it? And this is where the validation part is really important. It's easy for you to get lost in all of these things that you're building, but then you need to go back to and be able to say, this was validated. This is something that we reached our objectives with this hypothesis, or this hypothesis doesn't really work. This can be usability testing sessions. The worst is when you set up research, these chats with users, where are you going to show them a product, but you don't really know what you want to get out of it. I worked with this brilliant user researcher, Jerem White, and very often he would be faced, because he was the lead researcher in this whole tribe, he would be faced with multiple teams approaching him and reaching out saying that they would want to do research. And Jerem would very, very calmly just throw a question back at teams, which is a very typical move for a researcher, to just throw a question back at you. He would ask, what do you want to learn with this research? And this question, even now, it helps me frame what I'm looking for, because otherwise you're doing research for the sake of research.
Yes, this one is very powerful secret, and it can be applied to so many parts of our lives. You know, even your Zoom call with the manager, why are you even here? What do you want from your manager? Or what do you want to have as a result of this call? Even if you are not an initiator of this call, you came here, so you are spending time of your life. Anyway, can you name a few experiments that went really well or not really well at all?
I can mention, for example, something that we did in a lab scenario where we tested with people a way for them to be reminded of their medication. So, and I worked with Jerem. Me and Jerem were conscious that if we created a prototype, a clickable prototype that doesn't have people's data, that would be a bit detrimental to the experiment, because it would be important for people to set up these reminders with their own data to make it as real as possible. Otherwise, if you are setting up a notification for a medication you don't even relate to, we created this Wizard of Oz experiment where Jerem had an initial interview with these people, and he would ask some personal questions about their habits, and then he would jump at some point into the topic of medication. And as he was talking, he had a prototype that he was about to show people. I was changing the prototype on the fly, so live, adding all this personal data that people were talking to Jerem about. I was filling this prototype with that data. So when they would see this prototype, it would feel like a real product that had their own data. And when they were describing what they were doing as they were going through the prototype, they would give contextual cues on why they were setting the medication reminders for the times that they were. So the success in that is that people were using the product as if it was a real product in a real scenario, because, and this is my hypothesis, the data allowed us to create that environment.
Yeah, I guess it must be super stressful.
Yeah, it's a bit stressful. I just did this exercise, not me changing the information, but this designer, Phil, that I'm working with. And it's like writing a play. You have a script. We have the timings where Phil, you are going to be the one at this moment. You have 5 seconds to change this prototype. It's risky, but it's very worth it, because in more complex prototypes, you can even create moments where people input data and they see the result after that. It's something that might be personalized that we want to build with technology after we validate with these people.
What do you think these mechanics, while validating the product idea, help you to achieve? So speed?
Yep. It allowed my team to be able to test something really complex with a lot of logic. Now talking about the most recent example that we tested, where In this case, it was a questionnaire that had different results depending on the answers he gave. There were maybe like three things we could have done. So the first one would be to actually code this. Very, very expensive, very time consuming. The second one would be to build a prototype with all of these different scenarios, which is also very time consuming to go through all the, it was 137 scenarios that people would click, could end up on. Or we could have tested a prototype that has just a normal, always the same outcome. So only one scenario, but it wouldn't feel personalized. What we got was the fact that we could test the complexity of the product on the user facing side. They don't see what's happening behind it. And that's why it's a Wizard of Oz exercise, because they think it's really working, but actually it's us on the background moving all of these cogs for not as much time and money as the other two solutions would have cost us. So it allowed us to actually test the complexity of the product and validate it.
Let's say in the first step, you are collecting all this information. Then you are processing it inside the team. And then you are producing, let's say, clickable prototype. And then with the same person, let's say in 1 hour or 2 hours, you have some time to think and to actually implement these changes to the prototype. You're having the next session. Do you think it will work, or it will be not as good as Wizard of Oz?
Oh, you're asking about if it's a good idea to change the prototype on the fly. It's actually funny you ask that, because I saw someone on Twitter, and he was a designer from Instagram, and he was saying how cool it was that when he has that feeling of being in a session with someone, testing a product and understanding exactly how he could improve it and do that improvement before the next session and then seeing the results. And I asked him, do you think that's a good idea given the fact that you're influencing the testing? You have a different product. And he mentioned something which I do think it does make sense, which is it really depends. So it's the answer that sucks, but it depends. If you're talking about very simple changes that can improve, for example, navigation, they're not going to not use the product because you change the navigation. When you're talking about the very core concept that you're testing with people, changing it will not get you the answers that you probably want. You want to gather data that will be able to tell you, we should not continue to invest in this. And if you have one data point that tells you you shouldn't, and you fully change the prototype into something different, well, the second data point will be very different. What about that first data point? Is it something that would happen again, or it was just a one time? Well, now I don't know, because I have a different product.
That totally makes sense. And talking about design systems, so right now, Second Nature is quite on the early stage, and you already have some experience with design system at Babylon House, right? What were your core insights that you think will help you with a new design system in Second Nature?
It's important for you to create a shared understanding between design team, product managers, and even engineers that nothing is set in stone. And if there are good reasons to break the system, then I will be the first one to advocate to break the system. That's how you evolve it. But in terms of like good learnings that I got from Babylon, like collaboration wise, it's very important for everyone to understand this is not something that the designer owns. At the end of the day, it's engineers are the last ones to touch the product between users seeing it and engineers doing it. Now that we're setting up a design system in the team, like my advice for anyone who's trying to set up something like that is to bring engineers into the discussion from day minus one, because they are the ones who control things. They're the ones who ship. And you also find out that they have a very good experience with dealing with complex systems in their work. So their input will be crucial to building something that actually is good.
And it's interesting that you mentioned these changes to the design system. So probably in Babylon, you've already had a product and you were building a design system on top of it, right? So you had to implement some changes to the product, which is working, which is extremely hard.
Yeah, at Babylon, I was working in a product that was not yet fully launched. So like the risks in making changes live, they were not that big. We were still working on this pilot of a product, trying to understand how we could scale it to people with type 2 diabetes. That challenge is actually more evident at Second Nature, because it's a product that it's growing and already has a very faithful user base. It's actually incredible how this Rachel Walker, who's the designer at Second Nature, she's been able to design this product, being the solo product designer on the company. That's incredible. And the challenge is more now on this product that already has all these users that use a product on a daily basis. How can we change and improve this system and make it in a way that we can ship and not break things?
How do you do that? What's your one secret on top of your head?
I wouldn't say secret because I don't really hold that amount of huge knowledge. Approaching it from an iterative process, that's probably the best way. And the reason for that is because you do a lot of changes on the product as well, that you do it iteratively and you learn and you see if it doesn't work or if it does.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And let's talk a bit more about Second Nature and such an interesting topic, which is chronic conditions management. So what really did you learn in Second Nature that changed your life, changed how you treat these conditions? How do you treat these patients, your users, let's say? And what was your core insight from the product itself?
When we're thinking about chronic condition management, and I need to make a disclaimer that I'm not a doctor. I don't have a chronic condition. I am not even close to someone who does, but all I've been learning is that from working in products like from health tech for people who have a chronic condition. So don't take any medical advice from this podcast if you're listening to this, or even if you're a designer, please validate everything that I'm saying with the health professionals you're working with. But one thing is crucial and that has helped me like change the way I see solving problems for people with chronic conditions is we should strive to not build a product that is obsessive about a condition. I've seen people who just want to live, and I'm quoting, normal lives. Many people are just diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and it requires a change in their lifestyle. But these people are not diabetic. They are people who have been diagnosed with diabetes. And all the changes they need to make in their lifestyle, they don't need to be branded as diabetic advice. For example, eating habits, they don't need to be branded as diabetic diet. Because those terms, they segregate people into a bucket that keeps them exactly further away from the normal life that they want. It keeps them away from the Sunday lunch dinner with the Sunday lunch with family because they need to do the diabetic diet. And that just creates a poor relationship with changes that they need to make. Another example is, for example, a product that is obsessive about a condition and focuses on scales like weight or HbA1c and just asks people, how are you moving the needle on these metrics? And don't take me wrong, because these metrics are very crucial from a medical point of view as well to understand if you're improving or not. But looking every day at weight and scale in a product, or looking at your HbA1c value in the case of type 2 diabetes, and HbA1c measures the average blood sugar over a period of 3 months, like looking at these things every day in a product that just brands you as this person has type 2 diabetes, or brands you as someone who's obese, they label you under this condition and make you obsess over numbers, and make you obsess over numbers that you're seeing constantly, and just makes you want to get them down really fast. And that's why like weight loss programs are very famous. And I said they're famous, not successful, because they reduce weight very fast, but in the long term, you still have this condition and you might actually put this weight back because you are just trying to lose it very, very fast without it being sustainable. In long term, aggressive fat diets, they don't really help you build a habit. It's our second nature to you. And that's a twist that we're building at Second Nature, because we believe we're totally against, like I said in the beginning, we're totally against fad diets and quick weight loss programs. And we want to help people establish habits that actually last. So we believe this can only be done if we are not a condition or weight loss obsessive program, but people obsessive program. And for you to be people obsessive program, it requires a comprehensive approach. It's not only about focusing on what people eat, but how they sleep, how they think, how they feel, how educated they are about food and exercise and how things affect their body. You also need support as someone who has this condition. And that's why we have an exceptional team of coaches is focusing on that. So being forgiving and not being totally obsessed about a condition, but focusing more on the holistic approach about what people need. No one likes to be reminded, you have type 2 diabetes, you have to do the type 2 diabetes diet or anything like that. What if we frame this as, let's live healthily, and it has a consequence, it will help you improve these other things that exist in your life, namely weight, namely type 2 diabetes.
And chronic also means that you need to work a lot with medical adherence, because it's not just 1 week event. So you need to build a specific routine, small habits, maybe even bigger habits, and just make people really feel fine with them. So how do you work with this part?
Yeah, I like what you said about the small habits. Yeah, the chronic is tough because it's something that's for life. That's a very tough thing to hear. I had a very humbling experience of listening to people talking about type 2 diabetes and the moment they were diagnosed. And there was this one person in particular that they described how their doctor, in a very quick appointment, told them about the diagnosis, gave them a brief explanation about what they had to change in their diet, about everything they had to change in their diet. And they finally handed a pile of prints explaining more about the condition and the dietary changes they had to do. And this person told me and my team that when they left the appointment, they just tossed a pile of paper prints into a bin. And this clearly illustrates how the problem of being overloaded with information affects you. And that's why I said it. We should start small. It's not easy being told that your life will have to change. It requires a lot of time to process that news. It's very, very impactful. And on top of that, too much information is bad information. It's not easy being told that you need to change the way you eat, especially when sometimes you might have been doing this for more than 50 years, let's say. How do you digest this information? And when it comes to changing your life, as counterintuitive as it might sound, starting small, it does help. And at Second Nature, for example, our programs are broken down into different areas that you can focus on a weekly basis. And the coach's support helps people navigate this world of information, not just drown in it. And it's important that products help people measure their progress and see success. So you get that emotional connection with people when they are able to accomplish something, and you should just build up on that.
And talking about you personally, how did Second Life change your behavior?
Like I said, being more forgiving with myself, I feel like we're living in this odd period of history. If I catch myself snacking on biscuits or anything, I just feel like the world is a weird place right now. I'll be okay if I snack on some biscuits. That's been very helpful, actually, given the fact that these have not been easy times. So there are moments where I could have been doing a lot of things with this time that I have because I'm at home. But I came to the conclusion that the time that we're living right, like 2 hours in this time of pandemic, it's not the same 2 hours that he had previously. It's a different time. It's a different unit of time. You cannot do the same things you could before. So Second Nature has helped me understand that it's okay. Like, forgive yourself. It's okay if you're not doing so productive sometimes outside and inside of work.
Okay. And in the last 5 years, what new belief or habit has most improved your life?
I would say do stuff that this is not really a habit. Well, one thing that I started doing most recently, it's exercising. Since the pandemic started, there were moments where I was really excited to finish work because I was excited to work out. And that is probably the best habit that I've set. But again, going back to what I said, I'm trying to be forgiving of myself. And at the same time, trying to set up some accountability mechanisms where I sometimes work out with my housemates. And I have this friend where we have a challenge of working out 3 times a week. And if we don't, we will put money on a jar and then spend that money when the pandemic ends and we can go to a restaurant. But exercising has been life-changing during the pandemic.
Well, this one actually brings us to the question, what is one tough thing or action that you think is still worth it?
Do stuff that is not productive at all. I stopped doing that and I was heavily focused on like career and how can I use this time after work to learn something that's going to get me at an advantage. But I found that that doesn't really help me from a mental health point of view. So I'm just doing random stuff sometimes. I'm doing music. Am I going to be a musician? Am I going to make money from it even? It's not really the point. I'm learning chess and I'm excited about that. Am I going to be a grandmaster? Definitely not. I'm just doing it because I like it. It's really worth it to be reminded sometimes that it's okay to do stuff that's not productive, that doesn't fill the category and stereotype of productive. That's probably good because then you're at a much better position to do creative work inside of your job when you're able to disconnect from your job and do other creative stuff outside. that doesn't really have a purpose.
Yeah, I guess it just helps you to avoid burnout, because obviously just sitting in four walls, you cannot stay healthy, mentally healthy, without trying to switch to different activity. And how do you support your mental health other way than doing some extra activities like hobbies?
I've been riding my bike. That might sound really simple, but it's nice. It's a way of getting out and exploring the city. So when I came to London first year, I didn't really explore a lot. And now in the second year, I'm investing more on that. So that's been good. On the music side, like, it also helps with mental health. I usually do music that helps me say things that I don't really say. Yeah, and it's good because stimulates me creatively and allows me to like put stuff in words and other mediums like sound. Yeah.
And you're originally from Portugal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So sunny Portugal.
I know, right? I give up the sun.
Yeah, I've been living there for 3 months, and in summer, and I've been there like maybe 5 times, and I love it. Come on, how can you escape for London? I mean, seriously, one of the best countries in Europe, and I've been probably to almost every single one, except for Serbia.
Oh, what I like about here is the diversity of food. Like, yeah, well, sometimes I'm experimenting restaurants that I could never in Portugal. So I like that part. About the weather, yeah. I mean, London, if you get the sun, it's beautiful.
You have one day of sun per month.
Yeah, you start to value it a lot. I live in Camden, so like Camden with sun and without a pandemic, it's amazing. So I'm excited for those times. But I got to say, every time I go to Portugal and go to like Algarve, I'm actually trying to plan a trip with my friends there this year, hoping this thing goes away. But every time I go there, I'm like, I need to get a house here and just come and live here and work remotely.
Yes. I guess all seniors want to have a house there, and when there is no need to go to work, you can just go out, see the ocean, yeah, and just enjoy the sun. And what do you need? Yeah. Okay, well, some fish probably.
Yeah. Yeah. But for now, like I like to enjoy it from a holiday point of view. I'm not done with London. I'm really enjoying it here. And yeah, I know the sun thing is a bummer, but when you get the sun, it's really good. As a product designer, I'm excited to like be in London. There are a lot of opportunities, and right now I'm working in a product that I really, really like and I'm really passionate about. So yeah, home is Portugal, and I have a lot of stuff there, a lot of people. But for now, the plan for the next, like, let's say, year is London. But at the same time, I don't know what's going to happen after. It's not like I have a plan to leave anyways. So I'm enjoying it.
I just need to survive till sun comes.
Yeah. It's just waiting for the summer. This year's summer has the potential to be one of the best ever. People just wanting that feeling of connection again, like going out, having fun, being in the sun after so much time without it. It has the potential to be one of the best in a long time.
Yeah, that's very true. And one more question I have. This one is a bit more complicated. Do you believe that there are some good challenges and bad challenges? Just yes or no.
Okay, I'll buy that, yes.
So how do you know if this challenge is good or bad? Even a simple example, we need to change all icons because we want them to be more elegant. And it's like 150 icons, and you'll be drawing them for the next 5 months or, I don't know, 3 months. Is this a good challenge?
Okay, good challenges and bad challenges probably differ a lot on the priority and therefore on the impact that they have. So there are some things you can do, like there can be a challenge there, but the impact that you'll get from solving that, it's very low compared to some challenges that solving them will drive a lot of impact. Whatever this impact may be in a business scenario, maybe like revenue, it might be brand loyalty, whatever it is. Maybe the terms good and bad could switch between like impactful, not impactful, worth it, not worth it.
This is very subtle barrier because let's say your product designer can measure something, but for example, there is illustrator, I don't know, graphic designer, and they measure almost nothing. Well, often it happens so. And sometimes the challenges are more on the intuitive.
Good teams come up with good ways of measuring those things or finding proxies that allow you to measure those things. Things that might not be the exact measure, but it's an indication that something is working, something is good. something is creating impact. But like, there's not a problem to rely on intuition. If you fully understand that, you're going with intuition and your whole team understands that and they are on board if there are no other ways for you to be able to measure things. But as much as you can derive from data that you have and base yourself on that, I'd say that that's what allows you to then come back and say that this was something that was successful or not after you measure that. Daniel Burka, he posted on Twitter saying, what's this one thing that you never shared that it might be a bit controversial about design? And his was about picking fonts and how he was not that picky. He just picked something that looked good. And I love that thread because designers are people who are sometimes just so picky about things. They make the job so romanticized of it's exhausting sometimes to go on Twitter and read all of that. And I really liked it because it was refreshing. It was people saying, yeah, this is my job. This is what I do for a living. I love it. It's really important, but there's this thing that I don't think it's that important. And then you had all of these people making arguments in the comments to that point that Daniel made.
Yeah.
The point is there are things that I'm conscious that I'm not taking that much time to go into detail into certain things, but the cost of me going to details is bigger than actually just shipping something and learning if it works or it doesn't. And then I'm very happy to go back and say, I was wrong. I should have gone into more detail into something because I feel like sometimes we just spend too much time looking at very, very tiny details that don't really matter at the end that much.
One question I ask everybody, which is if you could write anything on the billboard, what would that be?
If I could write anything?
A personal message, not about the company.
It would probably be, it's okay to find. And this is like an old story, but it's this sentence I came up with and it represents the, and I'm making this word up, the okayness in just finding like yourself, finding the things that you like, finding that you don't like. So my background, like I felt something that heavily influenced this was the fact that I studied physics engineering for 1 year and I hated it. And then I switched to a bachelor in economics. And this switch was important for me to understand that nothing is set in stone. It's okay for you to find new things. And that's what my bachelor is in, actually. It's in economics. And then I switched to design.
High five, actually. I have also bachelor's in economics.
Oh, really?
Yes, I love it. I love it.
Designers in economics. Amazing. And in health tech. Amazing.
Yes.
That sentence, it's okay to find, like, it represents just okayness in you, like, asking questions and as a designer, like, everything is okay to find, like relating it to the job. But yeah, it's okay for you to find anything. Like it's about what you do with it that matters. But just absorb as much information as you can.
So it was really a pleasure.